You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
We don't like our presidential candidates cheating on their wives or visiting exotic lands like Hawaii. But when John McCain cheated on his first wife, he did so in Hawaii. Call John McCain and tell him the next time he cheats on his wife to do it in Myrtle Beach and not a foreign country like Hawaii.
I'm Cokie Roberts and I approve this message.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Hello and welcome again to another exciting edition of this Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. That is indie as an independent, which means we're not influenced at all by the five mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio airways. If you like your news spoon-fed to you by the corporate handlers, then this is not the place for you.
You can't handle the truth!
You know, I think you can handle the truth, and you get it unfiltered here each and every Monday on The Mike Cannon Show. The Mike Cannon Show is produced for the not-for-profit community and micropower radio use worldwide at the Glee Glee Studios. No animal products has been used in this production, subject to Wisconsin laws, but not valid in some states. Each week, we bring you alternative non-corporate programming from around the country and the world. Each week about this time, we start off the show with some shorter pieces like Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Women's E-News, and This Week in Radical History. It left the anti-authoritarian news and review segment from the folks at Eat the State. So here we go. Strap yourselves in and enjoy the ride. As always, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, fully unvetted, fully independent radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6. Thanks for listening.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Robert Shepard, a video producer and internet commentator for James Dobson's Focus on the Family Holier Than Thou Society. He is asking for people to pray for rain on Thursday, August 28th in Denver at the stadium where Obama will give his acceptance speech. Sure, it's boyish humor, Shepard asserts, but at the same time, it's something people feel very strongly about. They're concerned about where he would take the nation. Hey, you know what? It's not boyish humor, pal. There are droughts in North and South Carolina, parts of California, most of New Zealand. And this idiot, who firmly believes he can induce rain by prayer, is wasting it by asking his Lord and Savior to play a political prank. It's not boyish humor, and you're a selfish hypocrite. Stuart Shepard of Dobson's Focus on the Family, today's worst person in the world.
It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. You.
All right. Moving on to National and Monsanto.
Monsanto, which is well known for its genetically, its moves in the genetically engineered department to get genetically engineered seeds on the market. Their first genetically engineered product was bovine growth hormone, though. And it turns out that they announced plans this week to sell off the only plant that they have operating these days that manufactures bovine growth hormone. if we look at the recent history, major retailers in the U.S., a lot of major retailers in the U.S. have banned bovine growth hormone milk from their store brands. Safeway, Publix, Kroger, which owns QFC and Fred Meyer, have banned it. And Starbucks announced that they won't buy milk with bovine growth hormone in it. And then in January, Kraft Foods announced that they would offer a line of cheese products that don't contain BGH. So the movement clearly in the United States is against it. We're lagging behind the European Union, which banned it long ago, and Australia, Japan, and other industrialized nations that don't allow BGH in their food supply. And we just want to point out that bovine growth hormone treated cows have an increased amount of IGF-1, which is a growth hormone. So if you're drinking milk from cows treated with bovine growth hormone, you might want to consider switching because IGF-1 can cause cells to proliferate in your body, including cancer cells. So it's definitely a health risk. And not just to humans, but also to the cows themselves, because cows treated with BGH often need higher levels of antibiotics than other cows on a dairy farm.
And, of course, it's the marketplace that's had to decide this, because the FDA has been completely missing in action.
Yeah, the FDA and the USDA.
In fact, there was even a major effort to stop companies that wanted to print, you know.
Yes.
BGH
that
free.
That became illegal in order to do that.
Yeah. Imagine that. All right, moving on to international and the current conflict in Georgia and Russia.
Oh, goody. Yeah, believe it or not, this did not start with Russia's invasion of Georgia. Now, you may not be aware of that because U.S. media has not paid the least bit of attention to what actually started this crisis, which was when Georgia sent troops into and bombed the province of South Ossetia, which has a large which has a large Russian minority population in it, and which tried at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union to not be part of Georgia. So this has been a long simmering conflict, and Georgia did this knowing that they would provoke a reaction from Russia, and yet in U.S. media coverage and coverage by U.S. politicians, and particularly the White House and the McCain campaign, it has been all the poor, struggling democratic country of Georgia all the time. It's not quite that simple.
Yeah, nor is it simply because of the oil pipelines that run through Georgia either. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of people say, well, it's because Russia wants that oil. Well, not necessarily. There were a lot of things going on in Georgia right up to the time the bombing was ordered. It would be a reasonable as well as an intelligent thing to ask, well, why did Georgia invade South Ossetia? Well, Saakashvili, the Georgian president, had been under fire from the Georgian opposition for many, many months now. And in the weeks leading up to the attempted invasion of South Ossetia, Georgia had been experiencing massive demonstrations in the capital to try to unseat Saakashvili.
In other words, he tried to start a war to get domestic political pressure off of him.
Yes.
Where have we heard this before?
Yeah, that's a typical U.S. tactic. Well, in addition, Russia responded immediately. Russia's not blameless in this. In addition to bombing and going after Georgian troops, they went well into Georgian territory, bombed the city of Gori and several villages around it, which was not entirely called for. But you have to put this into the perspective of U.S.-Russian relations. The U.S. is a very strong supporter of Georgia, when other nations in the international community have not been. And the U.S. has been putting a lot of pressure on Russia through our foreign policy, which relies on this Cold War mentality of we must contain the Soviet threat, even though the Soviet threat is long gone. The U.S. has been putting what they call a missile shield program into nations like Poland and Czechoslovakia. Well, that's highly provocative to Russia.
Yeah. And saying that it's there to guard against threat from Iranian missiles, when you know everybody knows that it's aimed at Russia. It's not aimed at Iran.
It's not aimed at Iran. No.
Yeah. The other interesting connection about this is that the very typical idea of, well, let's start a war in order to get domestic political pressure. The president of Georgia has a very close advisor in the United States. He is the same man and the same lobbyist for the Georgian government who heads John McCain's foreign policy team. And so when you see McCain out in front on this issue and advocating for the poor beleaguered democracy of Georgia, bear in mind that he's getting his information from a very close advisor, and he himself, as he's pointing out repeatedly in the past week, has been to Georgia a number of times. He's very close to the Georgian regime and is not at all a neutral player in this, and in fact it's not at all inconceivable that each is scratching the other's back for domestic political purposes here, that the Americans told the Georgian leader that, yeah, go ahead and start your little flare-up and we'll back you up on this and we'll help you with your domestic politics, and then what McCain gets out of it is the ability to look presidential and to trump up his relative supposed depth of foreign policy experience compared to Barack Obama. And of course the problem with this is that both in South Ossetia and in Georgian cities like Gori, people are dying in large numbers, and these sorts of geopolitical games tend to mask the fact that ordinary people have their lives destroyed as a result.
Last week, he took that chance. After days of clashes in South Ossetia, Georgian troops launched a major ground and air offensive on the region. The Russians rallied to their allies and invaded the territory and Georgia proper. Today, the U.S. Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, arrived in Tbilisi to bolster President Saakashvili's standing. Though it has been reported that as recently as July, she'd warned him against entering a military conflict with Russia that he just couldn't win.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Russian President Dmitry Medvedev stated on Friday that Poland's agreement to accept a U.S. missile defense system target his country. Washington claims the defense shield is aimed at blocking attacks by rogue nations. These developments follow the recent conflict between Russia and Georgia. To further analyze the situation, the Real News senior news editor Paul Jay spoke to Eric Margolies.
Welcome back to the next part of our interview with Eric Margolies. Eric, just when we thought there would be perpetual war against Islamic fundamentalism and an endless war against terrorism and clash of cultures, all of a sudden we're back in the 20th century. What exactly is happening in Poland? And let me just to lead us into this, read you a quote. It's a quote from an AP story. The headline is, Russia, Poland risks attack because of U.S. missiles. According to Russian General Anatoly Nogovitsyn, Russia is ready to attack Poland, even with nuclear weapons. The quote goes, Poland, by deploying this system, is exposing itself to a strike. 100%, the general says. The general spoke at a news conference on Friday where he reiterated Russia's frequently stated warning that placing missile defense elements in Poland and the Czech Republic would bring about an unspecified military response. So, Eric, just what is this deal with Poland, and what do you make of the Russian response?
The Bush administration has been trying to close this deal for a long time to put anti-ballistic missile radars in the Czech Republic and 10 interceptor missiles in Poland. It claims this system is only designed against rogue states.
And they say it's defensive.
Defensive, meaning it's designed against Iranian long-range missiles. Well, first of all, Iran has no long-range missiles, has no nuclear warheads, poses zero threat to the United States, now or for the foreseeable future. The Russians are up in arms, literally, over the system. It's right on their borders. It will be able to look deep into Russian territory. The Russians say it's designed against Russia.
Now, exactly what is it? Because the impression one gets from reading American media is that this is somehow interceptors, that they knock missiles out of the sky. They're not themselves missiles armed with nuclear warheads that can then be used as a first strike. So what is the truth of this?
That's correct. It is a purely defensive system, but a defense has its offensive capability because the U.S. then is allowed, it can look into Russia, can see what it's doing, may be able to even confound or confuse some of Russian missiles if they're fired. We don't know all the technical details. They have not been revealed, but the Russians are extremely concerned. They offered to let the Americans use a Russian anti-ballistic missile radar in Azerbaijan to look south towards Iran. The U.S. said no. They turned it down. So the Russians regard this as an enormously provocative act. It is a clear and egregious violation of the agreements made by Presidents Bush Sr. and Clinton not to move NATO forces into Eastern Europe or parts of the former Soviet Union.
So how seriously should we take these threats about Poland being the subject of potential attack because of this deal?
Well, the Russians are taking it very seriously, and I do too, because if there were a major crisis, Poland's this missile system would be a primary target for sure. It's obviously Russia is trying to cow the Poles. But the most disturbing thing is that the Bush administration would go out of its way to provoke Russia by this unnecessary, foolish system. The primary goal of U.S. foreign policy has got to be to maintain stable and good relations with Russia, which has thousands of nuclear warheads pointed at the United States. They are going, the Bush administration is building this thing supposedly against the threat from Iran, which has no nuclear warheads, and to do this, it's going to antagonize Russia and bring them to the point of what looks like the Cold War. It's very frightening, is the height of irresponsibility.
Both the situation in Georgia, which, if one understands the situation correctly, was more or less instigated by many of the neocon hawks advising Georgia to provoke the Russians. Now the missiles to Poland. But one could have said this was something coming out of the Bush administration, not necessarily out of the sort of security establishment, which includes many Democrats. But that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing the whole foreign policy establishment in the U.S. on board with Bush on Georgia, and it seems with in missiles in Poland, too. And here I'm speaking of Obama and his advisors.
You're right, Paul. There's been a depressing uniformity of opinion in the United States on this, and by the U.S. media, which is beating the war drums over this issue, too, in the Western media. I mean, you hear Bush accusing Putin of bullying poor little Georgia. Mr. Bush is...
Well, perhaps there's nothing like a war to compete with the Olympics.
Well, that's true, but Mr. Bush, the pot who's invaded Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia, is calling Mr. Putin's kettle black. It's really exaggeration. In fact, there is a theory that the attack was launched against by the Georgians against South Ossetia while Putin was at the Olympics. And somebody in Washington, the theory is maybe Mr. Cheney, said gave them a green light through his neocon network to go and do it.
He doesn't seem to have informed President Bush, who stayed there watching swimming during most of the event.
Well, exactly.
But John Stewart, I think, maybe did the best report on all of this, where he quoted the American ambassador to the United Nations, who said how outrageous it is to have regime change in Europe. And Stewart made quite a joke out of the fact that it seems to be only a problem in Europe.
Mr. President, about the Homeland Security policy which allows border agents to search and seize Americans' laptops and other electronic devices.
Oh, big deal! Who wouldn't want the government looking through their laptop?
The government can also make copies of all your files.
Well, then, you better just make sure you ain't got nothing bad on your laptops. You know, like certain cartoons making fun of certain presidents. That's right, I'm talking to you.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Next February, the United States will make the switch to digital television, allowing broadcasters to simulcast multiple channels over the air and making your old TV set rabbit ears obsolete. Most of the talk about the so-called DTV transition is focused on the converter boxes needed to view broadcasts with an analog TV set. But Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report, says that the media are ignoring a much bigger issue.
What you're not hearing is that digital TV will increase the number of TV channels from 4 to 10 times. And then what you're not also hearing is who those new channels are going to belong to. The fact is that they're going to belong to the same guys who already have the old channels.
On the same amount of spectrum that it takes to broadcast one analog channel, there will be space now to broadcast several channels, depending on what kind of data you'll be transmitting, high definition, standard definition, or data. Back in 1996, a deal was cut in Washington that kept the broadcasters in charge of all the extra spectrum.
Ever since they've had broadcast licensing, one license has meant one channel. But thanks to this deal that they hatched in 1996 that virtually no one knows about, the current holders of broadcast licenses will get these multiple new channels without the hassle of multiple new licenses.
In 1996, then-Senator Bob Dole called the deal a huge corporate welfare program.
The channels will not go to any community groups, to any non-for-profit broadcasters, to any new commercial players, any minorities, any women, but that these new stations will go only to the people who already have them.
Dixon says the opportunity to create new programming will be lost if people don't act quickly. He wants a public outcry strong enough to be heard in the halls of Congress. The perfect focus for a protest is the transition test that will be held in Wilmington, North Carolina on September 8th.
If we want to make a mass breakthrough, if we want to get our messages across to mass audiences, then we've got to seize upon this opportunity. This is an opportunity to put hundreds or thousands of TV stations in the hands of other people who don't have TV stations right now.
To read Bruce Dixon's article, go to blackagendareport.com. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick signed legislation that will bring high-speed internet access to areas in the state where it's currently unavailable. Within the next 3 years, the law calls for the expansion of broadband into 32 communities throughout the state.
This is good news. This is really important news because high-speed broadband is the gateway to the 21st century world. Whether it's economic or educational opportunity or civic access, access to government and ways to simplify our lives and get access to information. And yet 220,000 households all across the Commonwealth and some 25,000 or more businesses have very little, in many, many cases, no access at all to high-speed internet.
Patrick chose Goshen, Massachusetts, a tiny town tucked away in the hills of the rural western part of the state, as a backdrop for the bill signing. The festivities took place in the town hall parking lot that serves as the local wireless hotspot. Hilltown residents are more than ready for better internet service.
We need it. We desperately need it. The school kids need it. We need it for business. The factories aren't going to be coming back here, but little businesses will come back.
There have been times where I've considered doing an internet business and just I constantly drop it because our connection is so incredibly slow. I mean, basically, I get online and get up and do dishes or or I'm reading a book at the same time. I'm, you know, multitasking in order to not lose my mind.
The law provides $40 million in bonds and establishes the Massachusetts Broadband Institute, which will obtain federal and private support to expand access and bridge the digital divide with investments in fiber, wireless towers, and other broadband infrastructures. It's not clear if state-of-the-art technologies will be deployed in the Hilltowns, but to those stuck with dial-up, even DSL sounds good to them.
Well, we have internet at our school, so that's where we do most of our research, and then we go home and write it up. But if we don't get enough research time in at the school, then we jump for joy when we get 32K.
For more information about the new Massachusetts Broadband Institute, go to masstech.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Diane Farsetta. In our top spin, who should decide if new construction might hurt endangered animals or plants? Why not the federal agency that wants to carry out that project? Currently, agencies planning new roads, dams, or other projects that might affect endangered species must submit their plans to an independent scientific review. The Bush administration wants to change that with what it calls a narrow regulatory change of the Endangered Species Act. Congress has rejected similar proposals for years, leading to charges that the administration is trying to dramatically change the law before it leaves office. The independent review system has been in place for more than 3 decades. One environmentalist called the proposal, quote, a case of asking the fox to guard the chicken coop, end quote.
The former spokesperson for Arlington National Cemetery, where U.S. service people are buried, is speaking out. She says that the deputy director of the site told her that he regularly called the families of fallen soldiers to discourage them from letting the media cover their loved ones' funerals. He had denied making such calls on several occasions, including in a meeting with Pentagon reporters. The spokesperson reviewed the cemetery's paperwork for troops killed in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. She found that nearly two-thirds of the families agreed to media coverage. Her support for allowing media access did not win her friends at Arlington. She said that because of her stance, her supervisors ignored her, limited her authority, and eventually fired her.
BP, formerly British Petroleum, is promoting its new gas with its first lifestyle campaign. The oil giant is highlighting its Invigorate gas additive. BP's five-year Younger for Longer campaign will compare its new gas to older athletes. BP says its gas extends the life of engine parts, just like a healthy lifestyle helps people enjoy longer lives. The older athletes featured in the BP campaign range in age from a surfer in his early 30s to a marathon runner in her mid-50s. The Golan Harris firm is supporting the campaign. The campaign includes a 15-city tour of BP's Invigoration Station, which offers activities like a climbing wall. While its previous product launches have simply discussed gas, BP hopes the lifestyle approach will help build brand loyalty among its target consumers.
Walmart has been portraying itself as green. Here's an example.
One of the major things we're working on is the development of a supplier energy efficiency program. So now what we're thinking is of developing, and we're doing further tests of developing a program that the buyers can use to get our engineers or third-party engineers into many, many more factories.
But that doesn't mean Walmart welcomes oversight of green marketing tactics. The Federal Trade Commission is deciding how to regulate marketing claims about carbon offset programs. Offsets are a popular way for individuals and corporations to buy environmental credits to balance the impact of greenhouse gas emitting activities. But with no regulation, there's also no guarantee that the offset proceeds actually benefit the environment. But Walmart doesn't want that to change. The company told the FTC that, quote, rather than attempting to define offsets or renewable energy credits, the commission should rely on the flexibility inherent in the reasonable basis doctrine. Different authoritative and expert institutions have adopted different but reasonable approaches, end quote. In other words, no firm definition should be created since there's not already a firm definition.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned the Golan Harris public relations firm. Golan Harris is a subsidiary of the Interpublic Group, the world's largest communications company. In 2006, Dow Chemical hired Golan Harris to run a global campaign to help clean up Dow's poor reputation. Among other unsavory activities, the chemical company has refused to compensate victims of the 1984 Bhopal disaster in India. Thousands of people died in the accident at a Union Carbide plant. Dow later bought Union Carbide. A Dow staffer wrote that the company hired Golan Harris to help stakeholders to, quote, better understand how its products, people, and actions contribute to human progress, end quote.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
My thanks to Mike Cannon at WNRB in Wausau, Wisconsin, who rebroadcast World Report.
Welcome to Media Minutes. Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of cheap oil.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers...
This week in radical history for the week of April 7th.
My name is Scooter, and this is the Inner Side Radio Program.
This week in Palestine, the service of the International Middle East Media Center, IMEMC.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out on WNRB Wausau, Wisconsin.
All these programs and more can be heard each week on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m., right here on Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
I came out here today because Ms. Pelosi was voted in by the people in 2006 to bring the troops home, no more war in Iraq, and change of direction. She's done none of that. As a matter of fact, she spent billions of dollars funding this war and the war in Afghanistan.
At this point, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan is as much the Democrats' war as it is the Republicans' war.
We have criminals, 35 articles of impeachment, and Nancy Pelosi, the facilitator, refuses to put it on the table.
I'm going to fight. Who gave you the right to take the Constitution? Stop the Republican. Who gave you the right?
An oath of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Don't tell me that I don't do that.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction. The danger to our country is grave. The danger to our country is growing.
The government of Saddam Hussein is a clear and present danger to the United States of America.
The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons.
Failure to end the danger posed by Saddam Hussein's Iraq makes it more likely that the interaction we believe to have occurred between members of Al-Qaeda and Saddam's regime may increasingly take the form of active cooperation to target the United States.
This is Corporate Watchdog Radio headline news for the week of August 13th, 2008. The Russian-Georgian war could mean a new Cold War between Russia and the West. And Walmart wants to keep green definitions fuzzy. Are we slated for a rerun of the Cold War? In all the talk about the threat to Georgia's democracy from an imperialist Russia, control over resources as a factor in the war has gotten short shrift. But no less than three key pipelines run right through Georgia. They supply oil and gas to Europe, and right now, none of them are flowing. Peter Zion is Director of Analysis for Strategic Forecasting, or STRATFOR, a geopolitical intelligence firm.
The Russians have never liked these three projects because all three of them were explicitly designed to avoid Russia and thus undercut Russian influence globally, not just in the region. So if these lines are going to continue to operate at all, they're only going to do so with Russia's express permission and on Russia's terms.
That makes Europe and its ally, the U.S., really nervous. They don't want to be dependent on the Russian bear. Zion says war could be the outcome, and he's hoping it'll be cold, not hot.
I mean, really, the best-case scenario we can hope for right now is a repeat of the Cold War. The Russians feel threatened, rightly or wrongly, and they're acting accordingly. What we've seen in Georgia is only the first of a great many things that they're going to be doing, and they're going to be using their energy influence in Europe as a lever of power.
Zion thinks the West, including the U.S., will build an alliance with Iran in a bid to bypass Russian control. You can hear about that by going to our full interview with Zion. That's at corporatewatchdogradio.org. Walmart is going green, right? It switched to fluorescent light bulbs, and it's installing solar panels on its roofs. The company's been trumpeting its commitment to sustainability for some time now. But critics have long wondered how much of those claims are greenwashing. Now they have a reason for their suspicions. It was revealed last week that the retail giant has been lobbying against FTC plans to modernize the green guides.
Those are guidelines for corporations to follow in making marketing claims about how green and sustainable they are. They'll tell you if those diapers can really claim to be biodegradable, for example. Walmart is worried that changes will tighten up the definitions of carbon offsets or renewable energy certificates. Stricter guidelines would make it more likely that marketing would be matched by real muscle when companies claim to be reducing or compensating for carbon emissions. But in testimony to the FTC, Walmart said the terms should remain flexible and keep their, quote, less tangible nature. For the Corporate Watchdog Radio headlines, I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Peak Oil Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
The price of oil has dropped rapidly in recent weeks. What's going on? And what do falling oil prices tell us about whether the world has passed its peak in oil production? The short answer to what's going on is that it could well be a random variation in a long-term trend of rising prices. And yes, volatile oil markets are exactly what we'd expect when global oil production has passed its peak. Let's look at the fundamentals of supply and demand. Tom Whipple reported in the weekly Peak Oil Review on August 11th, quote, "There has been very little change in the fundamentals of supply and demand during the last few weeks. OPEC production for July was up a bit, but this was more than offset by declines in non-OPEC production. U.S. demand for oil products remains about 2-3% lower than last year. Chinese imports, which are more volatile than those of other countries, were significantly lower in July than in the spring," unquote. Since China has reduced driving and industrial activity to lower air pollution during the Olympics, we may well see increased Chinese oil imports after the Olympics are over. On a percentage basis, the current bear market in oil is something we see a lot of in recent history. In a European Tribune article late last week, Jerome Guillet noted that the oil price drop at that time was a mere 14% from the record closing price. Drops that great or more have occurred roughly once a year since the beginning of 2003, while overall prices have ratcheted upwards by around $100 a barrel. Peak oil writer Kurt Cobb points out that geologist Kenneth DeFays predicted in 2003 that we would see great price volatility at the time of peak oil. He drew on the mathematical field called queuing theory to explain why. As Cobb explains it, quote, "There has been a very slim margin of spare oil production capacity worldwide for perhaps the last 3 years. This, along with robust oil demand, has almost certainly contributed to rising prices. As users and speculators crowd together on the buy side of the market, waiting to be serviced by the producers on the sell side of the market, they create a bottleneck. The surest way to get to the head of the line is to offer a higher price. That, of course, begins the bidding, as each buyer weighs how important it is to gain access to oil immediately, or at least to lock in a price at the current level. This is classic crowd psychology." Cobb continues, "Naturally, the whole process can work in reverse. As everyone who wants to bid on oil gets satisfied by the sellers, the line on the buy side dwindles. Now the sellers are a bit panicked and offer lower prices, as the few buyers left wait to see who can offer the best price. The price moves quickly and wildly up and down, but the system remains near capacity. If the spare capacity in the market were large, then sudden increases in demand could more easily be accommodated, and prices would not be nearly as jumpy. But with spare capacity razor-thin, the only short-term rationing mechanism is price." Unquote. That's Kurt Cobb. What does this mean for prices in the medium term? Jerome Guillet is writing a series called Countdown to $200 Oil, and he is undaunted in his view that oil prices are headed upward. While the U.S. has decreased its demand, demand growth overall is continuing in China, India, and most significantly, oil-producing countries. The decline in exports from oil-producing countries, therefore, is likely to continue, which spells bad news for countries like the U.S., where two-thirds of the oil used is imported. Giet says, our energy policy should focus on one thing first and foremost, demand reduction. And the smartest demand destruction is the permanent kind, that brings savings every month and every year, rather than one-offs like giving up a trip, unquote. If governments plan public policy, and you plan your life, as if $200 or higher oil is just around the corner, they and you are unlikely to be wrong. And you're very likely to be better prepared for whatever developments occur. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Okay, we're almost finished with the stock series, I promise. But I would be completely remiss if I failed to mention sweet corn stock, especially during this time of year when sweet corn is in abundance. Today, we're going to freeze sweet corn and make sweet corn stock. Now, sweet corn contains tons of natural sugars, and as a vegetarian stock, it is completely different from the shiitake and parmesan stocks we've discussed in the previous two episodes. However, just with the aforementioned stocks, it is incredibly easy. If, like me, you like to stock away lots of sweet corn for a little bit of sunshine in the long, cold central Ohio winter, you already have everything you need to make sweet corn stock. Begin with a large pile of shucked ears of sweet corn. Have a big pot of boiling water ready. I usually use my trusty 8-quart stock pot for this purpose. Also have a clean sink or a large bowl full of ice water ready. To prepare the corn for freezing, we are going to employ the blanch and shock method. Dip the ears of corn in the boiling water for about a minute, then remove them with tongs and immediately place them in the ice water until they've cooled. Repeat with the rest of your ears of corn, and then turn the heat on your pot of boiling water to low. Using a sharp knife, I like to use a sushi knife here, remove the kernels from the ear of corn. Just cut the kernels around the halfway point or a little lower. Don't dig the knife into the cob. It should slide right through the kernels. After all of the kernels have been removed, turn the knife over and with the dull edge, scrape the cob to get the milk and the germ from the cob. Throw all of the cobs into your pot of simmering water. Place the sweet corn kernels in plastic freezer bags, remove as much air as possible, and freeze. Simmer the ears of corn, and again, there's really no recipe here. I put as many ears as will fit in the pot and cover them with water. Simmer for about 2 hours and then strain. Sweet corn stock makes an amazing base for soups, especially sweet corn soup or chowder. It also makes great risotto, and the time to take advantage of sweet corn is now. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS, LPFM, 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus Community Radio.
Thank you. And now the winner of the Best Central Wisconsin Community Radio Station is voted by us computer voices. WNRB.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
He just took my arm and he twisted behind my back and he popped it.
How does a young girl named Ajanae end up injured by an East Orange police officer, remain in custody, and is released to a hospital without charges after 2 hours? In front of the high-tech East Orange police headquarters this past Friday, Amy Hayes, her brother, asked why the case is not being investigated.
We should not let this injustice sustain itself with acts such as these, such as breaking my little sister's arm. I ask the police force to breed more considerate police, police that make us comfortable around our own community. Right. How can we have a free America when we can't even walk around and enjoy our day without the police coming around looking at us funny and talking trash to us? I just want justice. That's all I want.
East Orange has long been plagued by poverty and crime. While new police methods brought 4 years ago by then police director Jose Cordero, a former New York City police inspector, seemed to have successfully brought down crime statistics, Ajanae's aunt, Tarisha Hayes, says she disapproves of a police force that shows little respect for young people.
This doesn't make any sense. Anytime you send your child to school, they should come home safe. Those are the ones that's supposed to be looking after our young people, not terrorizing them or antagonizing them for any reason. He should have been suspended without pay until the further investigation, not still working on the force.
Under heavy rain, the protesters marched back to a rally in front of City Hall. Esme Parchment, a 65-year-old grandmother, recalled a severe beating by East Orange police suffered a few years ago and said no one is safe.
I live here for 30 years. 7 East Orange police officers came in on my house and they beat me. I got 6 injections in this shoulder before I could use it. I was naked and they stare at me and they laugh at me and then took me to the East Orange General Hospital to say that I was crazy.
Oh my Lord.
Police brutality must stop.
For New Black Panther Party, October Carly, the victimization of black people is part of the system, and the community is usually left alone to demand its rights.
I say sue the East Orange Police Department, sue Cordero for instilling in the police the mindset that they can stick guns down somebody's throat, or they can break a young child's arm, or they can just run down on young boys anytime they want to. That's not policing. You want to reduce crime, start with the criminals.
Indeed, Mr. Carley from the NAACP pointed out that East Orange VIPs were notably absent.
Our ministers, our religious leaders, running for cover when situations like this happen. We have a black administration, black education council. Where are they? What is happening to our children?
But for this member of the community, time has come for a change, and she was there to put the authorities on notice.
So what gives the police the right to put their hands on a 12-year-old child? We won't rest until you are out of here and the rest of your thug homeboys are out of here.
Power to the people.
For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen in East Orange, New Jersey.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting August 18th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info was found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Fight the power!
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey!
Debunking the myth that America was founded on religious freedoms, on August 18, 1634, Arbane Grandier is burned at the stake for being a witch. Also on August 18, 1941, in a letter to President Roosevelt, Representative John Dingell suggests incarceration of 10,000 Hawaiian Japanese Americans as hostages to ensure, quote, good behavior on the part of Japan, unquote. Also on August 18, 1977, South Africa, Steve Binko, a leading student apartheid resistor, was arrested in Port Elizabeth, later while in custody murdered. To quote Steve Binko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Lastly, for August 18, 1996, the prison population rises to nearly 1.6 million inmates, double the number of a decade ago, the Justice Department said. This week in Radical History for August 19th, 1503, thou shalt not kill. Well, tell that to Pope Alexander VI, who dies accidentally of poison intended for his guests. Also on this date in 1692 in the New World, 5 people, including the town's former minister, hung in Salem for witchcraft. There is a long list of religious persecution in the New World, like the followers of Thomas Morton, who set up a trading colony upstate from the Puritans' Plymouth colony. This colony was much more successful than the Puritans' colony, for they actually treated the area natives as friends rather than hated Indians. Morton's colony had a live-and-let-live attitude, which included a monthly dancing around the Maypole Dance celebration. The Puritans could have none of that, and struck down Morton's colony, destroying it by force. The long, long line of religious persecution in the New World not only included Morton's colony and supposed witches, but anyone not of the Puritans' faith like Quakers who were regularly forced out of the New World colonies. Yep, America's founded on religious freedom. True, as long as that religious is pious enough. Otherwise, they're destroyed by the evangelical zealots. Also on August 19, 1911, Mexican troops battle for the anarchist Zapatista-controlled cities. Also on that date, 1953 in Iran, troops overthrow liberal-leaning premier and put the pro-Western dictator in power in a coup directed by the CIA, all to protect the American interests. Also on that date, 1958, NAACP Youth Council begins sit-in at desegregated lunch counters in Oklahoma. Also on that date, 1971, H.R. Haldeman, President Nixon's hatchet man, orders an FBI investigation of CIA news correspondent Danielle Shore, who had analyzed the president's speech, quote, unfavorably, unquote. Lastly, on August 19, 1989, South Africa Nobel Peace Prize winner Bishop Desmond Tutu's are among hundreds of black demonstrators who are whipped and sandblasted by helicopters as they attempt to picnic on the white-only beaches near Cape Town. This week in Radical History for August 20th, 150 years plus before the official founding of America, on this date in 1619, the first group of 20 African slaves land in Jamestown, Virginia. Also on August 20, 1886, sentences are handed down against the Haymarket trial defendants, found guilty despite obvious innocence. Seven anarchists are condemned to death. The hangings of the seven innocent men will take place on November 11, 1887. Lastly, for August 20, 1998, U.S. cruise missiles pound targets in Sudan and Afghanistan and accidentally in Pakistan, targeting pharmaceutical industry factories, maker of anti-malaria and veterinarian drugs. Cruise missiles precisely target and destroy the factories. Quote, there is no sanctuary for terrorists and no limit to the resolve to defend American citizens and our interests, or our ideals of democracy and laws, unquote, says Clinton's U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen. Still later, the U.S. finally confessed that it erred in claiming that the plant was manufacturing and storing nerve gas or any link to Osama bin Laden, as was previously stated. Oops, my bad. This week in Radical History for August 22nd, I only got a couple items. 1692, eight more persons hung in Salem, Massachusetts, charged with witchcraft. Also on August 22nd, 1968, Remy Davis tells Chicago city officials it would be, quote, suicide, unquote, not to allow demonstrators during the Democratic National Convention to sleep in city parks. Tomorrow, Officer Friendly posts 11 p.m. curfew signs in park trees at Lincoln and Grand Parks. The whole world will be watching the Chicago police beating and gassing everyone and everybody they can get their hands on. Lastly, for August 22, 1972, police arrest 891 over 2 days as thousands of anti-war protesters disrupt the Miami Beach Convention of the Republican Party. This week in Radical History for August 23, 1500 in New World, Christopher Columbus, accused of mistreatment of natives in Haiti, is arrested and sent back to Spain in chains. Could have threw him overboard and saved us a lot of trouble. Also on August 23, 1911, Ishi, last member of a Stone Age tribe in America, is discovered in California. For a great book about Ishi coming out of the wilderness into the white world, see the book Ishi of Two Worlds. Also on August 23, 1917, riots occur in Houston, Texas, when the 24th Infantry seeks revenge to the city's white police after a brutal beating of two black regimental soldiers. After 2 hours of violence, 15 whites, including 4 policemen, are killed and 18 more are injured. 4 soldiers died. 118 soldiers are charged in connection with the riots, and 19 are executed, most in almost total secrecy, in one of the most infamous court-martials ever involving African-Americans. More short items for August 23rd, 1946. 3 white men are fined $10 in Collins, Mississippi, for the attempted rape of 3 black women at gunpoint. And justice for all. Also on that date in 1962, always with a hard-on for Castro, JFK administration approves a massive covert sabotage effort against Cuba. Lastly, for August 23, 1996, Today, the net worth of the world's 358 richest people equal the combined income of the poorest 45% of the world's population. That's 2.3 billion people. Once again, way back in 1996, and it's gotten worse since then, 358 people have as much wealth as 2.3 billion people. Lastly, for this week in radical history, I only have one item for August 24th, 1967. Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin throw 300 $1 bills from the balcony onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to disrupt business as usual. It worked, creating instant bedlam as people scramble for the bucks. Hoffman received a master's degree in psychology from the University of California at Berkeley and is a co-founder of the Youth International Party, YIP, tried in the Chicago 7 trial, author of several books including Steal This Book and Revolution for the Hell of It. He committed suicide in 1989. To quote Abbie Hoffman, "Sacred cows make the best hammer."
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Special welcome to another station airing this weekly ditty. Welcome to listeners of KQRP 106.1 FM, Salida, California. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, as always and forever, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. You're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline. How many nights I prayed for this, to let my work begin. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. I don't like your fashion business, mister. And I don't like these drugs that keep you thin. I don't like what happened to my sister. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. Sent me the monkey
and the plywood violin. I practice every night. Now I'm ready.
First, we take Manhattan.
Then we take Berlin. Remember me, I used to live for music.
Baby.
Remember me, I brought your groceries in.
Baby.
Well, it's Father's Day, and everybody's wounded. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
I'm entertained for a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. So, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
This is 93.3 WMRB Wausau.
Free people, free radio.